If the present concern about the role of women in society and the church includes a concern to set right and reverse some of the stereotypes that have developed, then I should begin by saying, good morning, gentlemen and ladies. Having thought that over for a while, you're ready now to be introduced to the people who are on the program this morning. Before I do that, however, I'd like to acknowledge the presence in our group this morning of two sets of people. One, the group of people who have come to us from Valpo and the Chicago area and who are here primarily in the interest of keeping this male-oriented community honest by, in your case, being all women. We welcome you and look forward to your participation, I should say continued participation in the activities since you began your participation already last evening. The second group to whom we want to express a word of welcome is the group of seminarians from our brother seminary at Springfield, Illinois, who are here today as part of the seminary exchange program. We welcome you and invite your wholehearted participation in the goings-on of this day. Our first segment of the program this morning, as the schedule which you have in your hands indicates, is to be a presentation by Dr. Margaret Sittler Ehrmarth of Wittenberg College, Springfield, Ohio. In the spectrum of this week, you received some information about her, calling attention to the fact that Margaret Sittler Ehrmarth is professor of history at Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio, and that she is the author of the recently published book under the intriguing title Adam's Fractured Rib, published last year, which is an outgrowth of her study over the past 4 years, particularly the role in which she served as chairman of a group studying the role of women in the church for the Lutheran Church in America. Mrs. Ehrmarth was the first recipient of the Wittenberg Alumni Association's Distinguished Teaching Award, 1961. She has studied at the universities of Berlin and Hamburg. She received degrees from Wittenberg and Ohio State University, has worked for the American Council of Learned Societies, the National Archives in Washington, D.C., the Public Administration Service in Chicago, and, don't hold this against her, the Federal Tax Administration. She taught history at Gustavus Adolphus College before joining the faculty at Wittenberg. For the benefit of our colleagues from Springfield, I'd like to call attention to a needed correction. In the current issue of the Springfielder, there is a review by one of the faculty members of Concordia Theological Seminary at Springfield of Mrs. Ehrmarth's book, Adam's Fractured Rib. And the review calls attention to the fact that she uses the middle name Sittler. And the reviewer speculates on her identity as the daughter of theologian Joseph Sittler. Well, anybody who knows Joe Sittler knows that he's not old enough to be Margaret's father and that Margaret is not old enough to be Joe's daughter. They happen to be brother and sister. So would you please take that correction back to the editor of the Springfielder and ask for equal time in the next issue to get the facts straight. The committee planning this day learned of Margaret Sittler Ehrmarth as a possible speaker for this day on an occasion a number of weeks ago when Dr. Donald Higgins, president of the seminary at Gettysburg, was a visitor on our campus. We happened to mention to him that we were looking for someone who would be qualified to lead the kinds of discussions we had in mind for this day. And without hesitation, Dr. Higgis recommended most highly the author of Adam's Fractured Rib. And within a short time after that, I ran across a slightly older edition of the Christian Century, which carries a review of the book, but unfortunately, consistently misspells Mrs. Ermart's name as E-R-M-A-T-H. When I telephoned her at Springfield, I used this identification. She made no objection. She accepted our invitation. She's here, which is an indication of the kind of gracious person that she is. And I'm going to turn the program over to her now. She has approximately 45 minutes. That will be followed by a panel presentation by several women who are present, and then we'll break for smaller group discussions. Dr. Ermart.
Thank you very much. I know that it is very usual for a speaker to say how happy he or she is to be here, and I will also say this, and really from the heart, for a number of reasons. One, well, first of all, let me clarify a few things. In the first place, this tax bit. I was an editor. I'm just as sensitive to the whole tax syndrome as you are, and it was in my capacity at that point of being a professional editor that I was doing some work for the tax administration, an investigative or innovative program of in Chicago funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, which was trying to get rid of some of the hang-ups in tax. Well, anyway, I was an editor. Now about that Sittler business. I have to clear that up, too. It's right. I'm Joe's sister. But it was Fortress Press, as you may imagine, that capitalized and wished on every possible occasion to put the Sittler in the middle of my name. And so it goes on. And I personally have tried very hard to not to disassociate myself from Joe, but certainly not to trade on his name. I didn't think that was really kosher nor fair. But my efforts are in vain. Presses have their own way of doing things, and apparently they have carried the day. Now, I'm not going to argue with Joe, and I once had a big debate at Wittenberg raising funds for scholarship, and we debated the question, which is better, men or women? And this was, at least 40 years ago. But it just kind of sticks with you, you know. All right, now you know my attitude, so don't blame Joe for what I have to say. And for, above all, do not believe that his achievements or distinguished career in theological studies and biblical studies rubs off on his sister. I am what I'm going to describe myself to be and what will clearly be obvious to you in a few minutes. All right. Now, I can't resist reflecting something bubbled to the top of my mind as I heard the young Siebolds do their thing in chapel this morning, which I thought was very effective. It reminded me of a telephone conversation I had with my 6'4" bearded son, who is working now in Washington, D.C., and who had just taken the morning off to go to Happy Hill Nursery School, where his little daughter was in school along with the Kennedy brood, I mean those who were of nursery school age. And he was asked to perform for them as a father. Well, he bent his tall frame first over a table of little boys, and just in time to hear the teacher say to one recalcitrant and obstreperous little male, "Look, Johnny, if you don't behave, I'm going to put you at the table with the girls." Fritz rather was a little startled at that, but for once held his peace. Then he went over to the little girls' table, and he asked the teacher, there, "What do you do when the little girls misbehave?" And she said, "We make them stand in the corner. They don't get to go to the table where the little boys are." Another reason I'm glad to be here, I should say quickly, is I love to hear you sing. And at least if we consider the ecumenical thing among us, can we all say that Lutherans love to sing and that there is a basic community in that fact? And I, for one, am not prepared to fight any battles over having, let's say, 51% of human beings comprise the bass section or the tenor section of choirs. They don't have to be women, and I wouldn't even want it. All right, I'm awfully glad, too, that you have invited me, you students have invited me. Students are my milieu. I'm beyond the age where it's almost not quite respectable to be a teacher of anybody. I have my problems as parent, you know. We all have our hang-ups. But I do want to say that my community with students prepares me, I think, very well to understand some of the agonizing, I use that word very carefully, the agonizing and traumatic experiences which you are familiar with. You have indeed an identity crisis, but you have a lot of company. The church has an identity crisis. Women have an identity crisis. Everybody's having an identity crisis, and we should keep our eyes on one another. The search for identity is going on everywhere. All right, another thing that impresses me about your generation is your openness to discussion. Your openness to ideas. I know you have certain cliches, you think in certain cliches also, but that is not only young, it is human, and my generation tends to do the same thing. All right, now last evening, Dr. Horton addressed herself to the problem of women as they have been conditioned by certain aspects of society. She talked about certain social developments in the past and in the present that helped to shape society's image of what was male and what was female. Now, I would like to add a few things to what she said, give a few more illustrations, and then move the discussion in the same direction, but filling it in with particular with a desire to fill in those parts that will help prepare us for a discussion of women in religious life in general and in the life of the church. I would submit these rather shocking facts that the ordinary citizen does not know. In this land, for instance, in those states where there are laws against prostitution, where prostitutes are penalized, the prostitutes are taken to court, but not their customers. I would like to point out an anachronistic and strange law in Canada that says that when a family has a baby, when the wife or woman has a baby and she is has a regular job, that she is docked for the time that she's away having her baby and the time she finds it necessary to stay at home and take care of this baby. At the same time, however, her employed husband, who has certain responsibilities at home during this period, does not get docked for taking his wife to and from the hospital, from staying home when it's necessary to help her out. This seems to me to be a rather strange law. Another interesting fact I'll throw into the hopper is this, that since 1886, I think, there have been exactly 6 PhD dissertations written on the subject of women, all by men. All right, just a few extraneous facts that I've thrown in. Now, I'm going to pick up the discussion pretty much at the point where Dr. Horton left it off. Now, my two presentations have the title given you in your program, but I must say to you in all honesty that what I have to say in these two presentations are really of one piece. Women in the life of the church, women and ministry in the church seem to me part and parcel of the same thing. So what I'm going to do is to speak for my 45 minutes, although the chairman is going to have to remind me, like Pavlov's dog, I'm conditioned, as you know, like professors are, to go 50 minutes or an hour. So I'll try to stick with the 45 minutes, and when 45 minutes are up, I'm going to be still. We'll have enough to talk about. I could give this, what my thing, present my views under many titles: Women in a New Age, today's woman in today's world, or Adam's fractured rib and how she got that way, with the implication that, after all, Adam was the first mother. Women and the doctrine of creation. We'll get to that sooner or later. If Dr. Shalman is around, I'm sure we will. And he's scheduled, so that is, I'm trying to be very fair. This is going to be where the crux of the discussion comes to a certain climax, I'm sure. Another title could be Women and Men, if I'm talking to the campus girls of the Women's Lib movement. Or if I'm talking to the Rotary Club, I usually say men and women and their relationship to one another. I just reverse it, but this is a small matter. As this morning, for instance, you noticed that the male occupied the pulpit and the woman the lectern, and I would say, fine, that's a fine arrangement. I'm not going to fuss with that. We don't alienate our brothers unnecessarily. I could tell you some very interesting stories in this matter about getting into the Union League in Chicago, for instance, attending a meeting to which I had been formally invited and coming in the wrong door. I just, if the boys want to have their club, it's really all right with me. My spirit is such that I think, let's get on with the important things, and I will go around the block and come in the other door if I'd thought of it in time or even known which one I should have entered. All right, now the second thing I want to make clear is what the real burden of my message is, and then I will play variations on this theme for the time allotted to me. First of all, my view of God the Creator is that human beings, both male and female, have been placed in their habitat, the world of nature, the Garden of Eden, in a very, very fascinating and basic symbiotic relationship. That they are to serve one another and all mankind in that garden habitat to the glory of God. Now, that this is open to many interpretations is certainly true, but this is my fundamental idea. We'll try to spell it out. That God the Son, while he was on earth, assumed a certain stance and engaged in certain activities which are really, and used words which are to guide us in interpreting what God, the Creator, had in mind. He showed, as we put it theologically, the way. And that God, the Holy Spirit, is not to be contained in anybody's dogma or doctrine or creed or sex, but speaks to us continuously as we move on from age to age in the garden. As we interpret this, and it is interpreted to us, he says things to us about that are appropriate to the time, the place, and the circumstances in which we find ourselves. And certainly we find ourselves now in one of the greatest revolutions that mankind has ever experienced. All right, I would say again, or in addition, that creation in nature, creativity, evolution, the ongoingness of creation is indeed an ongoing process kind of thing. And that the church and the people in the church must take advantage of this and yield to it and serve it. I would also remind us of our long tradition as a pilgrim church, not caught in concrete nor in static situations. It is man who constricts. It is God who frees. And in this act of freedom, he frees both men and women to new possibilities, ever new possibilities, in bringing creative solutions or creative activities to a world which desperately needs them. Now, the next thing I owe you, I think, right off, is to make some statement as to my competence. It has nothing to do much with my basic education or the pedigrees and the things that are read off usually in introductory remarks. By what right do I use so many man hours and so many woman hours here, devoted by those of you who have been kind enough to come and interested enough to come to this meeting? First of all, obviously I am a woman, and I think that gives me some competence. And I've been one for a little more than 60 years, which is more than I think any woman in the audience, so far as I can see, and more than most of the men here, I am sure. So I'm a woman, and I represent one half of the human race, I think really 51%. According to somebody's census, this doesn't go in China. They haven't taken a census for a while, and you can't believe it anyway, but it's something like that. I kind of really regret that I'm not black, too. If I were black, it would solve a lot of problems right away. It would also steer the direction, the conversation in a way. Secondly, I am a teacher of history. And that I thoroughly believe what Santayana said, that if you do not read history, if you do not know history, he who does not know history is condemned to repeat it. Therefore, I believe that history illuminates the problems of the present and sometimes indicates paths which might be creatively followed. That cultural amnesia is just as fatal as individual, personal amnesia. History has taught us that life is given to us full of paradoxes, full of ambiguities. There is that terrific dialectic in life, or should I call it the swinging of the pendulum from one position to another, and that we cannot have life on any other terms but to know which way this pendulum is swinging and to be able to come to grips with life under those conditions is one of the great lessons of history. If, for instance, life has taught us in the past, or society has taught us, that men take a predominant position here, rightly or wrongly, it's not a question of justice or a question of equality, and women here, and that the pendulum is swinging back and forth, in that particular dialectic, in that particular paradox, in that particular juxtaposition of the sexes in this case, certainly something creative must come out of this. I also speak to you out of the academic life, which as a person, my husband died when my children were 1 and 4. I raised 2 boys by myself. I entered into academic life primarily for their sakes and found that I loved it and did it for my own sake too. But I mention that here because I had been exposed kind of unconsciously to what happens to women in academic life. For instance, it was 6 years, after 6 years of service, of teaching in a Middle Western Lutheran institution, I found out that they had a double salary scale, one for women on the presumption that women were who were brave enough or daring enough to go into the academic profession would be single women. And that men automatically had a higher salary because they were presumably heads of families. I paid a woman one-third of my salary to take care of my little boys while I went out to earn the living. And my salary was $3,000. That meant that $1,000 went to her and $2,000 supported me and the 2 boys and my helper. And then I found it was absolutely impossible to live on this and an illness. Also created difficulties, and so I took a job somewhere else at a somewhat higher salary. And only then did I find out about the double standard. It had never occurred to me to ask. That situation has been remedied both at that institution and in my own, but I have been exposed to a number of very interesting things of this kind by virtue of the fact that I was at once a woman and the head of a family and had responsibilities of that kind. This is the kind of knee-jerk response, you see, to the woman's situation, which I had been so naive as to accept, thinking that justice was done when actually it was not. I think you might be somewhat appalled to learn that in a first conversation I had with the chairman of a history department, in talking about my new job, he said that he had to overcome very serious compunctions in hiring me because his experience had been once that a woman secretary regularly took 3 days off every month and that this was a disability which he had to face, and he had to count this in when he evaluated a woman for a job. And certain things that are on the whole rather bizarre took place in this. I think, for instance, as the As a student graduate of and a history major at Wittenberg College years and years ago, the head of my department congratulated me on my work and that kind of thing, and never once had suggested that I go to graduate school. Actually, it was a woman, a Scots woman, who had her PhD from the University of Edinburgh, who made the suggestion that perhaps a graduate school might welcome a woman in history. And so there are a number of things like that. I recall being a student at the University of Berlin in the old days, in the old Humboldt University of Berlin, and I found myself in a class of about 400 males, and I was the only woman. It was an international law, particularly reflecting the German efforts in this regard, taught by a very famous professor, somewhat dull to listen to, but he was a very famous professor. And those two things, that's just an incidental. Not all German professors are dull. But I was a little shocked, and so was he, when he strode into the lecture hall with his mappa, his briefcase, and put it down on the desk, and all of a sudden saw a woman in the audience, and or in the classroom, I should say, and his facial expression rather changed, and I was a little surprised at this. I'd been used to being in graduate classes with men, but this was a little startling, and he formally opened his lecture by saying, "Meine Herren und Dame," this kind of thing. Well, I thought it was really on the amusing side, and I only really recalled this when I began to talk in public about these matters and scratch back in my personal background for some interesting experiences that might quickly get to the heart of the subject. I think I owe it to you to say that I'm a PK, a preacher's kid. I grew up with six boys. Owing to the fact that my older sister was not too well, I kind of was one of the boys. And I found them much more interesting to play with than the little girls. I don't even know if there were any around. I don't even remember the inside of the parsonage as a little girl. I remember on the outside. And the boys and I, they were schooled. They tied up my dress in ponytails in the back of me. And I could crawl over the rafters in the barn with them. And I could crawl under the wheels of the railroad cars along with the boys. And I could go down in the soapbox on the chute-de-chutes which they had built from the barn. I participated in all their experiments. I only realized later that sometimes I was, you know, kind of the thing experimented upon, but I didn't really think that was a male-female thing. I don't think it is now. I was simply there, and this was a little unusual at the time. And I never realized for a good many years that this was not quite the acceptable thing to do. Who instructed me in this, and what was the acceptable thing to do? It was, on the whole, the church. For instance, all of us kids marched down to Dad's church together, and I was told, when we came into the Sunday school room, by my Sunday school teacher, who taught a little class of you-know-what girls, that I should come in after the boys did. My own boys, my own brothers. Well, I thought that's the way it is, you know, so I did that. The same teacher told me at a Sunday school picnic when I was engaging in a sack hop race, some of my younger brothers were in there too, that this was not seemly for a little girl, particularly a daughter of the parsonage, that little girls really shouldn't do this kind of thing, and particularly since they were supposed to be examples to other little girls. Well, I placidly retired from the race, although I saw it as being much less dangerous than climbing over the rafters with my dresses tied behind me. But in any event, I took this again as one of those things in life, and this is very instructive. I am reminded, for instance, that as not too long ago, not too many years ago at Valpo, where I gave an address to women of the church, that when it came time for the public prayer, the women were not at that point permitted to pray for themselves and others, but a member of the religion department was brought in order to pray. I remember in the parsonage that a visiting missionary came unexpectedly to the parsonage on one occasion, And my mother, the mother of 8 children, had not managed to bring off all that big laundry that day. And so she very apologetically said to the visiting missionary, "I'm going to give you my little girl's room. She has slept in that bed just one night. I don't have time to get fresh sheets. I hope you won't mind." And he said, "Well, of course, sir, that's all right. I'm just not used to sleeping in she sheets." I remember that without rancor, but I remembered it when I went back into my memory to bring out illustrative material and to build up my platform, the platform from which I speak. I also remember passing the First Congregational Church in Columbus, Ohio, a very fine church. It has a marvelous parish program. It's in the inner city. It does everything it should do. But while I was a graduate student, they had dedicated on the church a series of 4 panels representing the life of the church, the ministry of the church. The first panel was Eve struggling with the serpent. The second panel was John the Baptist and Jesus. The third panel was Jacob and the angel. I assume unisex angels are supposed to be. And the third one was, I think, St. Peter ministering to somebody at the gate. Now I thought, I had been by that time somewhat sensitized, and I thought, with all the history of the women's service in the church, isn't it too bad that in the only place she appears, she appears in what I have called long since the Eve syndrome. I also should say that I am a veteran of many, many conferences in which I have been the only woman. I see the major advantage in being that there's plenty of room in the restrooms. Aside from that, I don't think there's really very much advantage. All right, now, in spite of all of this, and I think every woman anywhere can drag up, if she chooses to, experiences of this kind. And I think it takes not too much of an act of will, determination, and Christian charity to keep oneself nevertheless free of gross paranoia. I have taken a certain stance vis-a-vis the women's lib movement. I think I have openly, publicly called myself, in spite of my great sympathy with the origins of this movement and its noble purposes, I'm the Uncle Tom of the women's lib movement. I've had my confrontations with Betty Friedan, and if it comes to this point in the discussion, I'll be glad to tell you about that. I think I should tell you also that in my many talks with college students at my own institution and others, I avoid such terms as equality, rights, demands, and power. And I try consistently to speak in terms which are reflect my Christian bent and my human concern in this problem. I speak in terms of justice, fulfillment, creativity, and health of person and society. I want now to state my basic convictions that will frame everything that I have to say from here on in. First of all, that all suppression of personality, male or female, black or white or whatever, leads to the demonic. And maybe the history of women in society and in the life of the church will explain why it is that witches historically have normally been portrayed in the female form. This is a very serious matter. We don't use brutal words like this very often, but I think it's justified in this case. That gross injustices of the kind that have historically been experienced by women during much of history leads to gross responses. And I would consider Betty Friedan's public response anyway, not necessarily her feminine mystique, as being a gross response. And I use that word very carefully. The Episcopalians have a much better word for this, a much better phrase. They call it the delicate question. And let me say what I have to say about that. This delicate question of women in life and in the church is fraught with enormous danger and enormous possibilities. I would like to dwell upon those 2 things. Now, here perhaps is the most important conviction. that I have to point to, and that is that I believe thoroughly, fundamentally, that men are victimized and deprived by the traditional stance and views and practices vis-a-vis women. It is not only women who are deprived, it is men. You boys don't know what you are missing, and we don't know either. But that it is a fascinating prospect to see if we can find out. And I would say to all my sisters in the Women's Live movement that the stance of castigation, of attack, of confrontation is not really the right one, in my opinion. My fourth view is this, that the church bears significant responsibility for this plight, and that is one of my tasks today, to spell that out. Another conviction, the fifth, that humor and deep understanding, not abrasive confrontations, are called for. Yet, those of us who are women are indeed heartily sick of the jokes, the real awful jokes, that stem from the man-woman thing. Now, sixth, I have my own priority list about what things are pressing in our society. I believe seriously that as long and as difficult and as pressing as the woman problem is, that population explosion, the threat of pollution to extinction, the threat of war, take precedence now over the woman problem. But that we can really, as intellectuals, as students, as human beings, citizens, we can probably attempt to deal with these all at the same time. All right, now, I want to fill in a little bit of the historical background, pointing it to the subject we have in mind this morning. And here I call upon historical evidences. It seems very clear from what the archaeologists and the anthropologists have to tell us that women did all right at first. In the primitive societies in prehistoric times, it seems very, very clear that men and women fought their battle for survival, man against nature or man with nature. That woman had the paintings on the walls of caves, as I pointed out last night in informal response to a question, tell us that women were in the center of things. Now why? She didn't choose this, it just happened. And the archaeologists and anthropologists and art historians tell us probably because it was very clear to primitive minds, which weren't, after all, unintelligent, that something about the rhythm of the bodily function of the female was in phase with the moon. That fact caught them, caught their imaginations. And since the blood sign was there, and among all primitive people, the blood sign is a very important one, apparently, by virtue of what they painted on the walls, where they put woman and her sex organs and the rest in enlarged proportion, that they thought somehow this meant that the woman in the outfit had a special line to the universe outside the world, or their garden, their particular Garden of Eden. That somehow she had esoteric and intimate contact with that which they did not understand. Remember also that by virtue of the fact, and they also realized that she was the bearer of the future. She contained within herself, obviously, the future. And since they did not know and did not account for the interval of the 9 months between intercourse and the emergence of a baby normally, that they took it for granted that in some mysterious way she had been given a special function which meant survival for the race. By virtue of the fact that she was the bearer and the nurturer of children, she stayed near that fire when they finally discovered fire too. And fire was a sacred symbol. So you have the marvelous symbols, cultic symbols of fire and blood and babies and woman all together. Small wonder then that great cults, pervasive cults, which persisted with an inordinate consistently throughout primitive societies and after that in cults in the civilized world, had to put women very often in the center of things. This may be the reason why in the Judaic tradition and in the Christian tradition the desire to correct the cultic and pagan elements in certain religions threw the pendulum to the other side. So you have the heavy emphasis upon the patriarchal society, the man-dominated society. Now, as soon as men found out, well, several things conspired to this end. When they fell into conflict with other men, the population of the world was increasing. They had staked out their territory. They went into conflict. Muscles, military finesse, and abilities did indeed count. And the mother and the children and all that the fire symbolized was to be protected by them. So that kind of a division of labor took place. Last night, Dr. Horton talked about the change from a hunting to an agricultural society, very clearly laid out this function, division of functions, which came about at that point. Now, obviously, when ancient societies or old societies, including the Hebraic one, experienced times of high crisis, authoritarian rule came into existence. The military men, the authorities, took over. And this lived on very strongly among the Hebrew tribes and is reflected certainly in the Old Testament. Let me cite certain things from Leviticus. I know the questionable nature of that book, but nevertheless, it is quite clear, clearly reflects the Hebraic tradition. The reduction of women in status. The rule was that if a woman bore a male baby, she was unclean for 7 days, and it took 33 days for her purification after delivering a male baby. But if she bore a girl baby, she was unclean for 14 days, and the rites of purification took 66 days. You were in double jeopardy if you bore a little girl. I am reminded of the field of Russian history is one of my fields. And I have been conscious of this as I have read the history of male-female business in the Russian culture. And one of the things that startled me most was the knowledge that peasant women were fined if they delivered girl babies. Now, this has an economic basis, as the Judaic tradition had also. That is that male babies were much more useful as serfs than were female babies. You couldn't do without the girls, but you didn't want very many of them, so there was a special fine attached to a peasant household if it produced a girl baby. Now, I am reminded, let's jump quickly into the business of the churches. Among many conservative churches, it is still the practice that women may clean the church, but they may not clean the altar. They must stay away from the altar. They may raise money, but they may not participate in making the policy as how to spend that money. I leap quickly into another but related affair. You all remember that at Vatican II, whether you've read this or not, Barbara Ward, does that name mean anything to you? An outstanding, I think, a world authority on the have and have-not nations, a very brilliant and magnificently articulate British economist, was asked at Vatican II to prepare a paper on the have and the have-not nations. She's a very devout and very active Catholic laywoman. But when she appeared at Vatican II, she was asked to sit in the balcony while a clerk read her paper. I also had a paper from a Catholic woman theologian, the president of a Catholic college, who was present at a mass where there was no boy present to help the presiding priest. And although she was distinguished in theology with an academic degree, although she was a woman of great note in the Catholic Church, although she had assisted the church in 100 different capacities, they had to send out into the streets to nab any little Catholic boy who was to be found to be brought in to assist the priest. On the ruling that no woman dare stand behind the rail. Speaking of bar, reminds me that in Las Vegas recently, women made a ploy for getting to be croupiers. And they made quite a thing of it. I don't know why anybody wants to be a croupier, or women anyway, but they did. And they were told by the major domos that this would be bad news because the men playing at the tables or wheels or whatever would be distracted. I thought, well, what does this say about the seriousness of the gamblers, as what does it say about the priests, who, because a woman is a female, should not be behind the altar? And one of the reasons was that she was a temptress from the word go. Now, this brings me to the two stories in Genesis 1 and 2. Male and female created he them. I'll stay with that. Right, celebrate it. Someone, by the way, I have a series of quotes here that are irresistible. Someone has said, vis-a-vis the biological act of creation, or the creation as it stands vis-a-vis biological facts of life, biologically men and women different, or biologically women differ from men in ways which are a source of mutual consolation. I think that's delightful. All right, now, why not the other story in Genesis, or why the other story in Genesis, the Adam's rib syndrome? What is the real meaning behind these two stories? We will doubtless come to this a little bit later. Let me point out that on top of the Judaic tradition came a man who said, about the law, vis-a-vis the law, why he came to fulfill the law, that he broke apart many precedents which he thought were inappropriate to the law. This breakthrough vis-a-vis women was accomplished by Jesus. His ministry and his whole ministry, his teaching, what do we derive from his teaching? He addressed himself to the woman at the well, to prostitutes, to women in all stages, situations in life. He dealt with Martha and Mary in a very instructive way. He used women as his messengers. Women were present at critical moments in his career. And he was very relaxed. He addressed himself to them as persons. In other words, the teaching was they are new beings in Christ, and that the old traditions were to be broken apart and new ones formed. That this really, when all is said and done, is what the Gospels were about. All right, quickly, I remind you of the activity of women in the church. Since most of you are seminary students, I don't have to enlarge upon this, but has it struck you that their activities were conducted in an urban church, particularly, of course, in Rome and in Corinth and other places, where in their new freedom they became, and I guess the proper sociological and theological word is enthusiasts. In their new freedom, they were abundantly active, perhaps in Paul's word, super abundantly active. But I think this is humanly understandable, that they did participate in baptismal ceremonies and in the healing, and they prophesied, and that they enthusiastically went along with communal living in many forms, and that they were great doers, movers and shakers and doers in the church. We move then immediately, of course, and logically to Paul's position. And he has taken basically two. One, that women shall be silent in the church. Now, I don't know what to do with this besides say that he too was a product of his time and addressing people who were culturally conditioned by their time. They had been programmed to behave in a certain way. I think perhaps a benevolent, enlightened, and right interpretation of that thing on silence is that those who have not been properly instructed, or those who are naive or immature, should be silent in the church. And since maturity was in that day and age spelled out in the male factor, perhaps that accounts for it. I don't really know. Well, that's the business of the theologians, and I wish they would really go into this more deeply and not interpret silence as they wish to interpret silence. If your women vote, should it be not viva voce? All right. Now, Paul's second pronouncement is that in Christ there is no east nor west, no male nor female. You know the verse. Now, which is the abiding teaching? I think it is the second. I really think that is the thrust of Jesus' message, and I believe substantially it is the thrust of Paul's, that you can't blame him in his situation. Look at what the guy had to deal with. These recalcitrant, exuberant congregations. And his women were going to have a revolution, you know, in that church in Corinth. And he said, now look, girls, cool it. It doesn't really make any difference from the message point of view whether you wear hats or not. But remember, the people you're trying to put the message through to are hung up on this business of a woman having her head covered. They think you're going to be something else than you actually are. So don't let trivialities stand in the way of the gospel. If they think it's right to wear a hat, you know, or cover your head, for heaven's sakes, wear it. That is trivial. That's a triviality. And the same goes for hair and beads and beards and casual outfits or the collar or all the rest. Isn't this really true? That which inhibits the flow of the gospel should be abjured. Okay, I would like to know then why the first position is always quoted in the debate and dialogue on this delicate matter, and that we seriously consider what is the abiding teaching of Paul, since he's always in the forefront. I wonder what he would say now. All right, and we move quickly now to the Middle Ages. Maybe I should stop now. I forgot when I began. Let me get through the historical part of this. It'll take just a few minutes, and then we will sign out. In the Middle Ages, Dr. Horton mentioned that a few women were elevated to a romantic position, put on a pedestal or whatnot, and she gave the economic reasons for this. Well, I remind you that only a very few, including the Virgin Mary, were elevated to a high pedestal. And you are theologically sophisticated. You know why that was. The church was anxious to do a number of things. And why should not the Mother of God indeed be offered? I sometimes wonder what would happen if we all stood before a communion table and Mary helped administer the sacrament. What would happen? I don't know. I thought of this when I attended a communion service presided over by a very distinguished and able and gifted and beautiful a woman pastorian from Sweden who sang the service in Swedish and who gave communion to everybody gathered at a World Council of Churches meeting and service, and where she very gracefully, I mean really full of grace, said to the assembly, if there's anybody here who does not wish to commune in this fashion, let him give me a sign. And the Greek and Russian Orthodox priests, of course, did not take communion. I don't blame them, not one bit. I'm simply saying here, I wonder what would happen if incident after incident of this would be provided for us as test cases. In any event, in the Middle Ages, women and men, or women, were elevated onto some kind of a pedestal, but only a very, very few of them. The majority of the women were kind of bound to the plow and to the agricultural society which it normally was. In the first place, under the breakdown of the Roman Empire and the coming of the barbarians, both men and women religious took off to their nunneries and to their monasteries. The men, however, emerged as mendicants and friars and others, but the women stayed in the nunneries pretty much, although they did business, had business concerns, as you well know. The men emerged, but the women did not until the Reformation. And when they did emerge, how did they get in all those nunneries, stay in those nunneries in the Middle Ages? Because their families didn't know what to do with them. They were not educated. They could not do anything in public much, women of the upper classes. So they were put in nunneries as a place to put them. When Luther turned the keys in the locks, he was a little frustrated too. What was he going to do with them all? He parceled them all out, and one was left over, and he finally married her. That was one of the best things that he ever did. The worship of Mary, or the Mariolatry as it's called, is a phenomenon of the Middle Ages, which I'm sure you understand. But know that for the vast majority of the women in the Middle Ages, there was degradation on every side, social, economic, political, and personal. The Reformation meant a certain liberty, but but the church, although it gave liberty and eventually gave education to women, its history from then on in is not all that enlightened. And I'll deal with that in the next round. Then came the expansion of society all over Europe and throughout the world through the period so-called Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, and the French Revolution, American Revolution, English Revolutions. Women did indeed preside over salons, upper-class women, women of wealth. There was a goddess of reason produced in the French Revolution, as you've heard. God was kind of reduced to a button pusher, but I don't, who started the world and kind of sat back and let it run on from that time forth, but I do not see an immediate association here between the emancipation of women and the remoteness of God. This was a period also when utopias were dreamed of and many reformers got underway, including some women. But on the whole, 99 9/10% of the women were still in a subordinate position. Then we move into the 19th century when every student of history knows that it was the Industrial Revolution which paradoxically at once enslaved both men and women to those new machines which ultimately were to produce those things which led to, for the whole society of the West, a higher standard of living for both men and women. The work was arduous and cloying, slave-like. But it did bring women into other associations also with men, even if it was in the dirty mines, and even if the life for both of them, life period, tended to be somewhere around 28 years. Then came a romantic breakthrough in the 19th century, in which people like Dorothy Dix and Margaret Fuller, intellectuals and leaders, did attempt to bring women through to a new look at herself. You know the women's rights movement took place then. Let me remind you, however, of one thing, that with the women's rights political business in full cry, then came the Civil War period, the pre-Civil War period, and at a famous meeting in the East, the leaders of the women's rights movement said, "Women, we have done an important thing. We have an important thing still coming up, but there is something even more important than our movement, and that is freedom for the slaves." So the women's rights movement took a back seat at this point. When you begin to castigate or criticize the women's movement, remember that this is an historic occasion and I think a right and just, I would say Christian, decision was made at that point. All right, after that, women simply became members of the reserve labor force. When there was a need for their work, they entered into it. When they were finished with, when that crisis was over, they retreated. They shared this situation with slaves and ex-slaves, with children, with immigrants, with minority groups of all kinds. But whereas some of these other groups finally got up on the ladder, women tended always to remain at the bottom of the heap in terms of being always just the reserve labor force. What did the church do? Well, typically in the 19th century, they permitted their women to be missionaries, to engage in philanthropic exercises, to be deaconesses, to be teachers and nurses. The teachers, that was an elevation because it had been true that teachers, women teachers, were considered to be in authority over males and that this was not permitted to them. Indeed, education was ruled out for them some of the time. But then came the 20th century, I'll be done here in just a minute, when the true liberation came in two stages. First came the Industrial Revolution that speeded up into the Technological Revolution, and women could be used because of their soft voices or polite manners or something as telephone operators. Their delicate little fingers could run the sewing machines, the typewriters, and then they were upgraded to running cars, and now they're running airplanes and bulldozers, and they can be mountain climbers, and they can be almost anything they wish to be. In the First World War, with many American men off to the front, women went into the factories, and when the men came home, they left. Then, during the Depression, women were called to come out of their jobs because they were taking jobs away from men. In the Second World War, they went into the labor force in great numbers and into offices as well as factories, and they did not return home. And the present situation is briefly this, that marriage in the family has proved to many of them, rightly or wrongly, that they can manage both a family and even with children. And it should be noted that women comprise now 42% of the labor force. Some of you will say that's what's wrong with the country, but anyway, they've comprised 42% of the labor force, and that one-third of the women with preschool children even are at work. Then there is the phenomenon of the black matriarchy, and all of these things are symptomatic of that new age, this entire new ball game in which we find ourselves. Now, I would like to continue this analysis under the heading of the new age and the church in the afternoon's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.